Adventist Young Professionals presents the following breakout session as part of the 2025 Behold Convention. We hope you enjoy this session and the entire series of inspiring presentations.
So the first continuum is just curse and bless, and kind of where do you sit on that curriculum. Now, cursing and blessing is really important. I'm going to give you an example of that. Here's a picture of my two brothers and I. Okay, I'm the oldest. I'm there in the middle in that incredibly beautiful plaid. These are Christmas pictures, and this may seem like three sweet little boys, but I'm going to tell you, if you knew what was going on behind the scenes, none of this was pleasant. I don't know if you have, is there's a witness in the room or your siblings were the same way, but my parents would gather us together for these ridiculous photos and we were not happy. So David is the middle boy in the dark hair and the little baby Brandon, and we're within 4 years of each other, okay? So same biological parents, same upbringing, very close in age, and we have these lovely pictures like this. This was a real winner of a year here, I can tell you. It's a real curse. And then here was matchy matchy year. But what's interesting is that for those of you that are sociologists in the room, here's what's interesting. Same biological parents, same upbringing, okay? My youngest brother, the little baby Brandon, flourishing in his life now. We're all in our 50s, okay? Flourishing, career-wise. If I said, hey, let's go to Europe. If I called him right now and said, let's go, he would be like, let's do it. Let's plan this thing. Just kind of this larger than, you know, just kind of expansive. And my brother David always was the boldest of the three of us. He's kind of that middle child syndrome, you know, always, but completely opposite. Life's kind of shrunk, very limited, very narrow. How's this possible? Well, my youngest brother, Brandon, married a woman who has blessed him. There's the word, who's blessed him every day of their marriage. I mean, just praises him and gives him kudos. And in fact, after about a day at Christmas with them, I've had enough, just to be honest with you. All right, that's enough of that. And I got to take him down a peg or two, right? Because it's pretty obnoxious, actually. But his wife is just, you know, now for, you know, nearly three decades, just pours blessings into him, right? And, the middle brother, David, he married a woman who cursed him every day of their marriage. And by curse, I don't mean just the four-letter words, which there's something to that too. But I'm talking about stupid and ugly and useless and just diminished him until, you know, they got a divorce. But he, so I look at that, and I get that there's probably multifactorial thing, but I look at that same biology, same upbringing, same parents, I mean, very close in age, and I look at the power of cursing and blessing, and it's clear to me. That makes sense? Like, it's clear to me that words matter. So I want to start by just asking, you know, where are you and where's the culture of the place you work? How much blessing versus cursing happens there on your team, wherever you are? You know, where would you put it on a scale of 10, kind of, you know, a scale of, you know, 1 to 10 or something? Where does that sit? Another part of voice that we see is this is AYCE buffet versus fine dining. Anybody know what AYCE buffet means? All you can eat. Come on now. All you can eat. Maybe that's a pre-COVID thing. Maybe we don't get to do that anymore. So, well, actually, breakfast this morning was all you can eat, I guess. But, and this is about volume of the volume of language. Proverbs says, when words are many, transgression not lacking. Now, some of you aren't really literary thinkers. Some of you are STEM people. I know so you're like, well, what is this? So what the Proverbs are saying here is, so I'm going to give you a graph for you STEM people. You're going to latch. Quality and quantity are the two axes here, right? And the Proverbs are basically saying, as the quantity of your words increases, the quality goes down. Are you with me? The more I talk, the more I am at risk for saying things that damage people. It's a volume question. And you think about the world, you know, you think about the world we live in where social media and weighing in on everything politically and weighing everything, you know, just constant words, firing away on things, text messaging, just on and on and on and on. What the scriptures are warning us is that the more we have to say, the more we're at risk with our quality and the chances of sin go up. Make sense? And what I have found in the workplace as a leader is that one, when you speak for a living, which I do, right? That's the problem, is then you really got, if you're a leader, or you got to really think about it because you're talking all the, people expect you to talk all the time. So you got to be really careful, ratchet back the sarcasm, ratchet back the jokes, be really careful when you're going to critique something because you better, does that make sense? Like you got to really measure it. And as a team leader, I got to be really careful. I mean, we're kind of a size of a team in this room. I've also noticed like on my cabinet and things that two people tend to do all the talking and everybody else doesn't get a word in edgewise. And it's not always just because those two people are bad. It's that some people are just naturally more chatty. By the way, this in the classroom, this happens too, right? And you got to manage things carefully because when this gets out of whack, kind of the whole culture gets damaged. So I have tools and techniques I use in meetings where I'm like, I want to hear from everybody on this question. So I'm going to go around the table. Does that make sense? It forces the issue to go, no, I'm going to go, I want to hear from everybody here. Frost, who's the American poet, half the world is composed of people who have something to say and can't, and the other half who have nothing to say and keep on saying it. That's a good quote, isn't it? I think this is a big piece in the workplace and organizations. One is I got to measure how much am I saying by volume and how am I sort of making sure. This is why I don't like Q&A sessions like with my full faculty, for example. It's not because I don't love them all. It's because the same two people will ask the same question every single time. So who drives the agenda? Those two people. That's why open Q&As like town halls and, you know, and again, hospitals, you know, et cetera. The problem is if you open it up, you may not even be getting the best information or you may not even be getting the best dialogue because this volume thing gets out of whack. So how do I move to more of that fine dining? That's fewer calories of words, if you will, but it's really carefully chosen ones. And again, I would say there's two reasons I get into leadership trouble in my career. And one of the two reasons, one of them is just communication. I could talk about that later, just when you don't communicate. But the other one is just sometimes saying stuff and I'm like, why did I say that? Right? And it's usually the quip, the sarcasm, the joke, trying to be fun. And you can tell it just diminishes either somebody or something. And you're like, oh, that was not, particularly earlier in my career. Back to face. So you want to move from the left to the right on these screens from back to face. And of course, now we're talking about gossip. So a little confession. This was probably, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. My wife and I are in the kitchen and we're talking. And evidently we're talking about people or a person in our community. So just picture the scene. Like my wife, Nicole, and I are chatting. So my little guy, our youngest, comes into the kitchen. He's listening. He comes in the kitchen and goes, oh, dad doesn't like that person. My heart was in my throat. Dad doesn't like that person. And so I, no. And I said, well, no. It's not that dad doesn't like it. I realize, you know, there's no talking my way out of this. And so he leaves the room to go play Legos or whatever he's going to do next, right? And I look at Nicole and we're like, this got to stop. Like, we got to quit. We got to quit this. The problem is that all of you in this room, you gossip. I just make critical analysis about what I see. Are you with me? Everybody else gossips, but I, you know, particularly when you're in leadership and it's my job to critique things. So I critique the pluses and minuses of people in my workplace. I critique the strengths and the flat spots of people in the church when I was pastor. You follow what I'm saying? we let ourselves off the hook so that if I'm saying it critically, it's just doing analysis. When everybody else does it, then they're it's gossip, right?
Can I just set that down there? Is that better?
Good. All right. I'll keep rolling here. So I think this becomes a critical question. I saw a definition not long ago that if you know you're gossiping if the person you're talking to thinks less or worse than the person we're talking about. If you want a definition for gossip, it's if the person I'm in a conversation with thinks less or worse about the person that we're talking about, then it's the definition of gossip. All right? If you take nothing else from this early morning thing, I don't believe anything would have the power to positively transform the organization that you have in your mind right now. Church, where you work, maybe even your family life, nothing would instantly, for free, change the quality of the organization or the group you're a part of than just being super rigorous about this. My wife knew that I was working on this topic, and she said, oh, I just read this quote. Looking at everyday human interactions, imagine how many times we cast spells on each other with our words. So this is really charged language. Over time, this interaction has become the worst form of black magic. We call it gossip. Gossip is black magic at its very worst because it's pure poison. We learned how to gossip by agreement. When we were children, we heard the adults around us gossiping all the time, openly giving their opinions about other people. They even had opinions about people they did not know. Emotional poison was transferred along with the opinions, and we learned this as the normal way to communicate. Gossiping has become the main form of communication in human society. It has become the way we feel close to each other because it makes us feel better to see someone else feel as badly as we do. Interesting, huh? So, so to me, this one, you know, they're all big, but to me, this one's huge. All of the talk that we do behind people's back and how that damages the culture of our organizations, our communities, our churches. And what's interesting is, to me, is when I hear preachers preaching or, you know, people standing up front, all kinds of topics about the evils in the world and having correct theology and doctrine, I mean, all kinds of stuff. I hear very few sermons and presentations that talk about just the poison that is gossip and how it destroys human community. And you look in the scriptures, you know, you look at, I mean, it's just, it's full of concern in the text. So, you know, how do you move from back to face? By the way, the only time you should talk behind someone's back is you compliment someone outside of their presence. Like if you're married, you drop a nice compliment about your wife, knowing that the person that you're talking about when she's not in the room, and that gets back to her friends, that's pure gold right there. Woman's head. Complimenting to the face, of course, that's good. But if you know someone was talking well of you and you weren't in the room, that feels about as good as anything can feel. So that would be the exception here to talking behind someone's back. If you do it in a way that's just really pouring life into someone. Fantasy to factfulness. This one, we won't spend a lot of time here. This is obviously moving towards truth, and truth is really hard sometimes. This is part of the reason why some of you know about the Stroop test. You've maybe used this in a class or something. And of course, here it's pretty easy to read these, right? Across the top, red, blue, green, red, blue, green, green, red, blue, green. And it's because there's congruence between the words and the color of the word. But the Stroop test messes with it. You've seen this before, right? Now it slows everything down. Now it's not intuitive anymore because it's not telling the truth. And this becomes incredibly difficult, right? Huh?
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, did you see that? Right. So it says red, but it's actually in blue, and blue is red, you know. So, and this is really a picture of, I think, what we contend with, right? So obviously in social media world, clearly there's all kinds of information out there. And knowing that that you understand and are communicating truth becomes really a tricky thing. Now, it's easy to blame, well, some politician or something that's out there. But what about my own voice? How do I know that I'm communicating the truth? Because the bottom line is, when you're making arguments for a living, and I make arguments for a living, right? I mean, that's what a lot of us do. I got to really check myself, because if you say it, your initial instinct is that it must be true. Now think about it. If you say something, you think that it must be true. So I've realized that there's a couple ways I've got to make sure I'm speaking, preaching the truth. One is that when I'm in a team meeting, I almost always ask the group, I need you to stress test what I'm about ready to say here. I need you to tell me the weaknesses in my argument. I'm very impassioned about what I'm about ready to say or what I'm proposing. Now I want you to push back on it, right? I want you to challenge it. Where might it be wrong? And the strength of that is, first of all, it holds me accountable. Does that make sense? It's opening up an invitation for people to make sure that I'm not off track. But secondly, when you're the team leader, do you know what that does? It models for everybody else on the team that that's the way that we're going to function. So whether it's a church board meeting, or it's your senior leadership team where you work, or whatever board committee, whatever that is, you start to create a culture where challenging ideas and because is not like to offend someone, but it's the way we do things because we want things to be as truthful as possible. And the only way that happens is in community, there's accountability. We good? Where there's community, there's accountability, okay? And that happens when you model it as something that's normal and healthy to do. So I think the pursuit of truth always requires this activity. And of course, the Proverbs famously says, somebody seems right until somebody else comes along and cross-examines. You know that proverb, right? So how are we doing cross-examining in our own lives? Personally, who's cross-examining you? Who has permission? And I'm going to tell you, when you're in leadership, people almost never want to tell a leader the truth. You ask, can you tell me where I need to improve? You get the weakest answers back because we're afraid of leadership. You follow me? We're afraid of recriminate. You know, you have to constantly be pushing this idea that you want to hear truth and that you want there to be open places of communication. And if the leader doesn't model that openness, you're in real trouble. So that's a big one. Gas and water. So this is moving from being the kind of person that when you hear a spark of controversy, you carry around a gas can. And what does a gas can do to a spark? Kaboom. Or are you the kind of person that walks around with a bucket of water? And what does a bucket of water do to a spark of controversy? It cools it, right? It puts it out. So Sandy Ann Pass is in Oregon. By the way, I'm going to keep arguing for the Pacific Northwest. You got to take a trip. It's a pretty remarkable Garden of Eden, let me tell you. But at the top of one of these passes, you have this sign. And of course, even if you're not from the American West, you know what we deal with out there, right? Fires in the summer. And I stopped one time with my iPhone and grabbed this picture because it gives you a choice. It's warning motorists. You can either keep the forest beautiful and green, or you can contribute to their demise. And the way you do that is how you handle fire potential, right? What kind of person are you? Now, I'm going to violate the don't gossip rule here that I guess I'm going to be confessing all morning here. But years ago, there was a guy we worked with and we called him Gasoline Gary. Why did we call Gary Gasoline Gary? The minute there was controversy, the minute there was something, you know, crazy at work, the minute anything went right, if Gary finds out about this, kaboom, right? Kaboom, here it goes, baby. And I think this is really important. One, self-evaluation. When I hear a little bit of gossip about the church, a little bit of gossip about something going down on my campus, a little bit, Do I have a calming spirit? Take it in stride. Assume the best. Gain the facts carefully. Does that make sense? Do I, or am I like, wow, did you hear what's going on the second floor? Or wow, can you believe this is going on between these people? Or does that make sense? Like, I think this is a really big one. How do I handle information when it's hot? And there's going to be hot information all the time. And I think building a culture of water bucket carriers and not gasoline, you know, carriers is really a big deal. It doesn't mean that I deny if something's a problem. I'm not talking about blindly, but it means my disposition is to assume the best and to assume the position that I'm more of a firefighter than I am an arsonist. And I think this one is really key. And it's all about our words. It's no other body part. It's all about the language we use. So moving from gas to water. The next one I think is, again, a bit of self-inventory. This is moving from a place of being unhinged to hinged. So another Pacific Northwest story. I will guarantee you some of you are going to know what you're looking at. So here we go. Do you know what you're looking at right now? So what are you looking at? Do you remember the story? Yeah, so this was a flight out of Portland, I believe. I think it was heading down to California. Boeing flight. The door blows out, right? So the NTSB aviation investigation takes place. Why does this thing blow out?
Tuck the door.
Somebody forgot to put in the bolts, you remember? So the door was unhinged. And what happens in a kind of a high pressure situation when the door is unhinged? Flies out, right? This is what happens when you have a pressured situation and you're unhinged. So here is the truth about you and certainly about me. You can decide if it's the truth about you. The truth about me is God made me to be an emotional being. This is not sin, but sin does, to be an emotional being is to be the way God made you. The emotions are good. Okay, I did my doctoral work on this, by the way. The emotions are not bad, but what does sin do to the emotions? It screws them all up, right? So what happens when I don't get a good night of sleep for 3 or 4 nights in a row? Emotionally, I become a little bit unstable. What happens when I catch a cold and I don't feel well for a day? I become a little emotionally chippy. What happens when one of my kids is malfunctioning at home, or I've got a stressful patch in my marriage, or or there's a financial crisis in my life that I'm dealing with? Or what happens? I become emotionally a little thin. Does that make sense? In other words, some of the bolts come off of my emotional door. Is it just me? Can anybody relate, right? So what I realize is when I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror, I have to do a little inventory. What is my emotional state? Because I'm going to have a misfiring kid, attention point in marriage, financial stress, get sick, don't sleep well, traveling too much, whatever. That happens. So how am I feeling emotionally? And what I realize is when I'm not in a good emotional place, you know, whatever it might be, grumpy, irritated, really tired, etc., I know that that's a day to zip it. That's a day when I'm in the team meeting, say as little as possible. That's a day, have no opinion day, right? This is, I will have no opinions today about anything. Is that because I know that my filters are not where they should be. And this doesn't mean I woke up like horribly sinning. It means that fatigue and sickness and stress are a part of life on planet Earth. And I have to be careful when I'm in that emotional state to not just unleash as normal, because I'm not, the connection between my emotional brain, my amygdala, my vocal cords is broken. It's not okay. And so I try to go, all right, this is not a day to fly at 35,000 feet. I'm going to keep the old plane on the ground today vocally. And so I want to be making sure that where I am on that unhinged to hinge scale vocally. Mouth to ears, you know this one. the old God gave you, you know, one mouth, two ears. That ratio is important for how much usage you give. And it's a 4-to-1 ratio if you consider the eyes. So how do I use my eyes and my ears to sort of control my mouth? Story. I live in nothing, little nothing Walla Walla. 60,000 people. And these are not counties in Georgia where there's like 113 counties or something like that, 119 or something. These counties are massive out west. They are huge tracts of land. And there's like 60,000. So there's nobody where I live. So we go to Atlanta a couple years ago where I lived for many years, but we go to Atlanta for Christmas and Atlanta has everything Walla Walla doesn't, like shopping and entertainment. And like there's a million of everything in Atlanta and we're all, you know, and I got my youngest kid, we're in a car. He wants to go buy, you know, buy, shop, buy. Cause you know, so we're headed to Walmart. He wants this thing at Walmart. Christmas, drive into this big, you know, mega Walmart and parking lot's packed, but as we're heading in, and he's talking a million miles an hour, dad, and we go in, and he sees, so he's using his eyes, he sees a man, a trash bag, without a home, and a little dog. My kid sees it and goes, Dad, we got to do something. What are we supposed to do? Now, this is my kid who, when we go to the pet store, he wants to emancipate all of the cats. No, not one of the cats. Not one kitty. All of the cats. We must free them all from their condition, right? He loves animals. So, well, what do you want to do? We got to get that little dog some food. All right. So he leads me into Walmart and we head straight to the dog food section. I help him pick out an appropriate, you know, bag of dog food, pay for it. Back to the parking lot. He's completely forgotten about everything he wants to buy. Right? Back to the parking lot. Pause a minute, waiting for a police officer who's engaging this man to leave. And I said, now, I'm going to sit in the car. So you got to go on this one. He's like, yeah, you're going to go. So I rolled down the window of the car. I wanted to hear what was going on. So here's my little guy going out there, little bag of dog food, right? And gives it to this man. And they exchange Christmas greetings. And my kid comes running back to the car, gets in. Next 20 minutes. Complete silence in the car. And then it wears off, right? Of course. You know, of course. When I use my eyes and ears to look at the suffering of others, it has the anatomical effect of shutting me up. I have less to say about everything when I'm actually seeing the suffering and I'm hearing the need of somebody else. And I think this is a big push here. And if you're not in an environment where you're seeing the suffering of others on a regular basis, you got to figure that out. Because some of us end up in corporate jobs or leadership jobs, and we end up talking about the suffering of others, but you're removed from it. This is the problem with leadership. It's not because you don't want, but it happens to us, right? Now, if you're a physician, you're on the front line, you're seeing people who are hurting, but you start getting in leadership and you get removed from it. Commentary to coaching, another one, as you think about the power of voice. What's the difference between commentary and coaching? So let me just be, if you can handle a sports metaphor, I don't know if some of you are going to be like, come on, Alex, I'm going to bring the sports metaphor. This is pretty clear, the difference between commentary and coaching. So on the left, two Super Bowl commentators from I guess this was a Super Bowl ago, but, they have microphones. What do they do for 3+ straight hours? They talk, correct? Talk. They comment. Basically saying everything possible about what they're seeing. They just chatter for on and on and on. The gentleman on the right, Shanahan and Reed in this case, to coach football, they also have microphones. Do you see that? Strapped up to them. They also talk pretty much nonstop for 3 hours. But what's the difference? And what's the difference with coaching? Mentorship, guiding. They're not just describing things. They're talking about how to do better, how to accomplish a goal. I have a colleague. I have a colleague from healthcare who would always. His phrase was, "We spend a lot of time admiring the problem." You should write that phrase down. We use it now where I work. Admiring the problem. And you walk into a meeting for 3 hours, and it's like the first 2 hours and 55 minutes, we just admired the problem. We just talked about the problem. We commentated. It's raining outside. That's almost like, that's a useless comment. Well, say it once and it's not useless, but talk about how it's raining outside for 3 hours. Now, conversations about umbrellas, that's coaching. Does that make sense? Conversations about the solution to the rain, that's what you call coaching. And it's true in meetings. And I fall victim to this. We all do. We can spend a lot of time just moaning and groaning about the gravitational forces and not about how we're going to get lift. We do this, right? There's nothing wrong with diagnostics, with diagnosing a patient's problem. But if you just diagnose and you don't suggest a therapeutic treatment, what are you doing? And so I find this really helpful in my team meetings as a leader. I want to make sure that we're spending just enough time to talk about the problems, acknowledge them. You really got to talk about the solutions. And this sucks up so much life. You think about church boards, you think about educational, I don't care where you are, the amount of time we spend commenting on the obvious. And nothing could be lazier than to talk about all the problems in American politics. Check, got that box checked, all right? How all the problems in the church, check, got that taken. Is that like, okay then. But what are we, how are we talking about the solutions? That's where the voice should be. So where do you sit on that commentary to coaching? I'm playing with language a little bit here. I hope you appreciate this. Please give me some kudos for this. This took a lot of time to think about on an airplane somewhere. Not for profit to for profit. Now, people of prophecy, Adventists claim to be people of prophecy. I'm going to say a couple things about prophecy. One, most prophecy in the scriptures, by far, when you look at it, is not about predicting the future. It's about speaking into the present moment to say we can do better. Do you agree with this, biblical scholars? Most of it's not just predicting the future. There's some of that. But most of it's the prophets, God sending, we can do better. And we're going to talk about how we can do better. That's the, and by the way, this is very much Ellen White too. It's not about just predicting the future. There's some of that. But it's about how can we do better? It's God speaking into that, you know, the future being not for profits or negative profits, but being positive profits. Of course, there's an element of critique. But if I just, you know, but this is about, you know, kind of a positive view of what can come next. And I'm going to tell you why this is so important. And I'm going to another sports metaphor. This is what you get when you get, but this one's kind of a recreational metaphor. So here's my friend Richie and I, and he's a foot taller than me. He's an attorney. He's a lawyer. And this is a picture of us golfing. So when we have opportunity, we go golfing together. And here's Richie before he steps up for a shot. Here goes nothing. I always hit it in the water on this hole. Here goes nothing. I always shank this into the woods. Here goes nothing. I can never hit this 6-iron. Here goes nothing. This putter never works for me properly. Every single time before he swings the golf club, he is a not-for-profit. He predicts, he names that what's about to happen with his golf ball is pure misery. Are you with me, brothers and sisters? And what I find is that there's often a connection with him between the negativity he has towards himself and about what's going to happen and then what happens next. So I've kind of taken it as a project the last couple of years. Right before he gets up to address the ball, I say, Richie, this is totally your hole. You're going to flush this shot. This is exactly your distance. Or I think this putt's going to go in. Or you just look really good to. And he kind of laughs. He knows my game. The game is up, right? He knows what I'm doing here. But I swear to you, I notice a difference. I try to put positive thoughts into his head before the physical action. By the way, Seventh-day Adventists, this is very much Adventist theology since forever. We've talked about whole person care, that the human being is an integrated being, spiritual, mental, social, physical. Is anyone with me this morning? Does that make sense? I mean, this is, I'm giving you the most Adventist possible messages. This is what we have said forever, that there's integration of the human, that there's a relationship between the voice and what I say and what comes next. So if I'm in a team meeting as a leader and I'm going, this is going nowhere, or I say to my assistant, well, I'm walking into this disaster, drag me out of here in 15 minutes. What's that meeting going to be like? It's going to be a disaster. If I walk into something and go, you know, AYP, this is going to be amazing this year. It's amazing how amazing that amazing language will make it be. And this is not just hocus pocus or some weird, this is actually how God made us to work. Positive language that comes out of us has the effect of bringing positive outcomes. And by the way, any of you that are in education, you know this is true of children, of early childhood education. If you tell a kid they're stupid, you will destroy them and they will perform at a lower level. You tell kids they can do it, and what can they do? Rise to the occasion and do it. I mean, we know this intuitively. And that's why if you're preaching, if you're teaching, you're up front. I'm going to talk about this in a different session a little bit as well. It's so important to pour positive things into people's ears. Now, I'm not talking about cheap rah, rah, rah. I'm not talking about just, but I'm talking about speaking positive things into your team, the people you're around. It's incredibly important. And you've read stories about the guy that went to the Walgreens and got terrible customer service every time he went to the pharmacy at Walgreens. Every time, bad, 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 bad. But then he shows up one time with a plan. And as he's leaving, he goes, I just want to thank you so much. I just get the best service here. And he starts doing that every time he goes. And what happens to his customer service every time he gets there? He gets the best customer service. You want great service on an airplane? When you walk in, you say, it's so good to see you. By the way, I just want you to know, I'm just Alaska Airlines. That's my airline, you know, Alaska Airlines. You guys rock. Do you know what kind of service you're going to get the rest of that flight? You're going to get first-class service. I'm telling you, the power of language to seed in the mind, it's incredible, and it's a tool that we should use more. GGTTW and humility. Any guesses? God's gift to the world. So this is the, you know, I am God's gift to the world versus a voice of humility. And this movement's really critical. So you're looking now at Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural. This is 18, in the spring of 1865. Abraham Lincoln, second inaugural. This is just 6 weeks before the South will surrender. This is just 6 weeks before Abraham Lincoln will be killed on a Good Friday, on Easter weekend. Second inaugural. By the way, Lincoln's speech at the second inaugural is viewed as the single greatest piece of American speechmaking in American history. It's viewed as sort of the pinnacle speech. It's up there with MLK's speech. It's for presidential speechmaking, MLK's speech and this one, right at the top, right? And at his inaugural, tremendous courage. And I love this old footage. If you can see, these are former slaves, former enslaved people, and you'll notice they're carrying weapons. So it's part of the parade. Now, for us, it's like, well, what does that mean? In 1865, to have people that have been emancipated from slavery carrying weapons is a powerful statement that Lincoln's making here, right? Think about that. This is a powerful statement about where he sees the country going. This kind of freedom. And I mean, this is remarkable. But his speech, by the way, again, is the high water of American presidential speech making. Now, if you go to Washington, D.C., which is one of my favorite places in the world, by the way, I love going and taking the families off, and it's possible. You go to the Lincoln Memorial, you climb up those white steps, make a right turn. and you will get a chill down your spine and a tear in your eye, and you will stand in front of the full text of the speech. This is the whole speech right here, etched in stone. And what you'll notice in that speech, first of all, biblical scholars, seven different references to scripture in the speech. It is drenched in the Bible, which is really interesting, by the way. It's drenched in scripture. But the power of the speech, why is it such a great speech, is Lincoln, in this deeply divided country, argues everybody's on the hook for the problem of slavery. We're all at fault. We're all responsible. He doesn't say you're responsible, but these people aren't. Everybody's responsible for this. And everyone should benefit from the future where we're going. So he's not saying one side is wrong, the other side is right. One side deserves the blame, the other side gets the benefits. Everybody's to blame, and everybody can be a part of a future. Now, in the 21st century, in 2025, to hear this kind of politics, it would like, we'd all be like, what am I hearing? I mean, no one talks like this anymore. Am I speaking the truth this morning? Yeah, we just don't talk like this. Everyone's a fault. We're all screwed up, and we all can be a part of a better future. That's why this speech, and you'll remember some of it probably from school with Malice Towards None, Charity for All. Firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right. Strive to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who have borne the battle. For his widow is orphaned, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and loving peace among ourselves and with all nations. So he takes it to an international space as well. So you see why it's such a great speech, this sweeping vision. But it comes out of a single idea, and that's that Lincoln's humble. To stand up front and go, I'm part of the problem, is not something you're going to hear from many presidential candidates, right? I'm part of the problem here. It's humility. And this is such a huge part of moving forward as a leader, as a person, an organization, to be willing to admit that you fall short, you're part of the problem, your thinking is flawed. This sort of confession of being a sinner. Does that make sense? And it opens up the hearts of people, this kind of humility, and it allows for this kind of speech making in all of our lives that really, you know, that really make a profound difference. There's this old idea of leadership that you shouldn't admit a mistake, or you shouldn't admit that you're I think in this day and age, I don't think people resonate with that kind of leadership. Now, it doesn't mean you say inappropriate. I've heard plenty of leaders that go way to the other and they say inappropriate things up front. Like, we do not need to know about that particular sin. Like, that might be inappropriate. That was TMI. Does that make sense? I'm not talking about inappropriate. I'm talking about saying, hey, I'm in here with you, skin knees. I make mistakes. I'm a flawed human being. Does that make sense? Like, we're all part of this together. And I think that sort of leadership is really important. And then lastly, and then we'll, if we have any moments to chat. I don't have a clock in front of me. Where are we? Oh, my goodness gracious. This is what happens without a clock. Phobia and agape. All right. Perfect love cast out fear. You know the Bible text, right? Perfect love. We got started a little bit late. So perfect love cast out fear. And this is a move towards the language of fear, which destroys people, and into the language of love. So made a horrible mistake about a year and a half ago. Got a phone call. Would you like to come preach? Yes, I said. Did not consult Father, Son, Holy Spirit, or my wife. I said yes. Why? I'd been to 48 states, two left. This was one of the two I'd never been to, Alaska. So I said yes. Great. We'll see you the second week in January. Did you catch that? Second week of Alaska, January, tracking. Yeah. So I had to make the best of it. So I got my kid and said, all right, go with me. We'll make an adventure. Not an adventure listening to dad talk. So I had to come up with something. Trust me, that was not going to be the adventure. So I'm thinking, all right, connect to a couple of my Adventist friends up there dog sledding, right? That's classic. So we drive 2 hours outside of Anchorage. In the winter of winters, you start seeing these dog kennels up there, right? This is the seat of the Iditarod, you know, the great, you know, intercontinental. So go up and, you know, imagine a big field, 80 dogs, chained to 80, kind of like those Snoopy houses, right? The minute we get there, these dogs are going nuts. wagging their tails, crazy barking. They are crazy. We learn they're crazy because they want to be the one to be on the team to pull us. These dogs love, they're just wild. So I don't use the word epic because it's way overused, but this was epic. And check this out right here. So this is just absolutely pure magic. And I'm like Dad of the Year award this year. I gave it to myself, by the way. I just, you know, pinned it on my own chest, Dad of the Year. And then what's amazing, oh, humility. Yeah. I confess my sins. So, okay. Yeah. So, I mean, this was just pure magic. And then, and then at the end, it's the dessert, which is the puppies. And so these guys are like, you know, talk to me, you know, play with, pet me, you know, play, you know, they're just sweetest. This is sweetest. These Alaskan Husky and type dog, you know, they're just so sweet. And then here's a picture of my kid with our lead dogs there. So here's the lesson I'm leaving you with. Here's the lesson. Fear, love. Here's the lesson. Two things about those dogs that I learned that are so true about us and the people that we lead in our organizations. One is those dogs love to work. They want to pull a great cargo. And that's so true of human beings at our best. We want to do something great. That's just the way we're wired. We want to like produce something, pull something. You know, that's where we find meaning in life. This business of, I just want to retire early or I live for the weekend. That's garbage. That's not the way we are. Good people just love to do meaningful things. God made us that way. So that's true. And the second, so that's one thing I learned about these dogs. It's true about us. The second thing I learned about those dogs, they love it when you talk sweet to them. Good dog. You're the best dog. You know, you're going to pull me today. Like, they love it. And you know what people want in our churches, our schools, our workplaces? They want the language of love. They want to say nice things. They want to hear sweetness. And you give people those two things, a chance to pull a great load with a great mission, and you flood the airways with language, all the things we've talked about. You flood it with language. If you didn't do anything else in your company but those two things, give people a great mission and flood the airways with the right kind of language, everything we've talked about, you'd have it, I think. So I apologize for running long. I'm getting the stare down from my boss over here. But anyway, I hope this was helpful. It's been super helpful to me to think about this over the years and to try to flood the places where I need to try to think about how we use language.
Thank you for joining us for this breakout session presented by Adventist Young Professionals as part of the 2025 Behold Convention. We invite you to explore the other sessions in this series and continue the journey with us.